Welcome back, everyone, to My Faith Core Chemist. I'm your host, Geraldo.
And I'm Beck. This is the last week of our Pride Month special, and we're really excited to share with you the last two scientists on our list.
Remember, Black Lives Matter today and every day. So with that, here's our show. Hi, everybody. Today, we are so excited to introduce you to an incredible scientist. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Hi, my name is Adair Borges, and I use she, her pronouns. I am a recent graduate from UCSF, but I originally come from Billings, Montana, after which I did my undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In Pittsburgh, I studied the eukaryotic brain parasite Toxoplasma gondii, which got me really interested in host-pathogen interactions. And so I decided to go to UCSF, where I studied the actually bacterial antivirus immune system called CRISPR in Joe Bondi Denemy's lab. So CRISPR is really popular as a gene editing tool, but it originally evolved to protect bacteria from viral infection. And so bacterial viruses are called phages. And so I studied CRISPR and bacteria and specifically looked at how phages use what we call anti-CRISPR proteins to protect themselves from bacterial immunity. And so this got me really interested in phages and phage biology. And so I'm going to keep studying phages at UC Berkeley. And next week, I'm starting my postdoc to do that in Jill Banfield's lab.
Yeah, I remember a couple years ago when we got a seminar on CRISPR, like everybody was like, oh my God, this is like so cool. I mean, I don't know much about it because I'm a chemist, obviously, but
yeah,
I remember it seemed very cool.
It's a really fun system to study because it's like one of the most ancient immune systems out there. So you can learn so much about, you know, immunology actually from studying this bacterial immune system and what it can do, I think, like for enabling gene editing and potentially like moving into the clinic is incredibly exciting. So CRISPR has been like a really, really fun and like scientifically rewarding thing to study during my PhD.
Yeah, I think that the many applications that it has is like what it's so amazing about it.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to learn about. I read the book by Jennifer. I always mispronounce her last name, so I'm going to butcher it.
Doudna.
Doudna. There we go. She wrote a book called A Crack in Creation, and it's a really, really interesting book. So, Geraldo, if you want to borrow it, I have it.
Perfect.
I'm very fascinated by it, and I know like very little about biology and microbiome. but yeah. So kind of to start us off, can you tell us about how you got interested in microbiology? You mentioned a little bit about your academic journey, but can you tell us a little bit more about that? And then what do you love most about it?
Yeah, so I got interested in microbiology pretty early in my life. It started in high school. I had a really amazing chemistry teacher who pushed me to start doing my own science fair project. So every year we would have like a little chemistry project. And for my chemistry project, I decided to explore the chemistry that microbes can do. And so I learned about how some microbes out there are capable of producing hydrocarbons like methane, and also there are microbes that are capable of degrading them. And so I wanted to see if I could cultivate wild microbes and get them to do some of these chemistries that I thought were like really interesting and also like very important. So I took my high school chemistry project really seriously and just like kind of morphed into this like 2 year long project that spanned way past the original assignment. I ended up like making my own kind of like little lab in the basement of my dad's office building and like making my own like materials and stuff from like hardware store stuff. And I became friends with all the chemistry teachers in my town, and I would like hit them up for different chemicals that I wanted to do my experiments and stuff. And so, yeah, after like 2 years of messing around with that and getting really interested in microbiology and all the cool stuff that microbes can do, I decided to go to college and keep studying microbiology there.
That's nice.
That's amazing. Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before, but I feel like most scientists that we talk to have like one or two like really, really influential teachers from maybe like high school or undergrad. And that's amazing. I loved my high school chemistry teacher too.
Same.
That's why like I decided to go into chemistry. But yeah, that's the power that like good teachers can have on our lives.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah. Shout out to Miss Carson in Billings, Montana. Did a great job.
So moving forward to your graduate studies, how was your experience during your PhD at UCSF? Did you feel supported as an LGBTQ plus grad student?
Yeah, so overall, I had an amazing time doing my PhD at UCSF. I had some really incredible mentors, and I really love the science that I got to do. Like we were talking about studying CRISPR and studying microorganisms and like putting all these pieces of like evolution together was so much fun for me. As a queer student, I would say that there are some times that I like felt pretty lonely as a queer student. When I started graduate school, there was a student-run LGBT group that I went to some events for, but it actually went defunct after, like, I think after my first year there. So, and that was pretty much it for representation. And so I had to work, I would say, pretty hard to find a solid community at UCSF, but the people that I ended up meeting and the people that I ended up being close to were amazing. And, you know, I graduated and these are, you know, some of my best friends. Like we Zoom all the time and like are in constant contact, which is like really nice to have that, like, you know, stay past graduate school.
Yeah.
But yeah. Not I guess a lot of institutional support, especially like during the beginning of my time as a graduate student there.
Have you seen a difference since you like started your PhD and now that you like finish it in your department at least?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I have changed a lot like from being like a younger graduate student over the course of like the 5.5 years that I was there. I think that there has also been a change in like the departments and the way that the institution maybe recognizes queer students. And I think a lot of that has been to do with the work that like myself and you talked to Robbie and a lot of other student leaders have done to kind of like raise the visibility of queer students and queer trainees and also make it like a thing that the institution, you know, now knows like some of the people to recognize and hopefully like knows a little bit more about like the language to use when acknowledging like their queer trainees. So I think it is a bit different now and I hope it like continues on that forward trajectory of having, you know, biology and science be like, you know, I would like it to be like aggressively queer inclusive.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think when we've talked to graduate students in other departments, at this point, we've talked to like a decent amount of graduate students from different departments across the country. But I think a lot of times we hear is that the social aspect, the social community, although it might be hard to find once you kind of have that in graduate school, that like helps a lot in feeling supported and getting through graduate school, whether that be like in your department or outside of your department. But I think almost always, like without doubt, we hear that answer of there's not really institutional support. There's not really, I mean, like even at the University of Michigan, like the University of Michigan is a pretty progressive department, I would say, and they're still like lacking some of that institutional recognition and support and like training of professors and PIs. I think like especially recently when like academic Twitter has been kind of like pushing labs and departments to like really reflect upon like what they really mean by diversity, equity, and inclusion and how words are one thing and then action is something else. I think that that's like a pretty common thing that we hear from queer students and Yeah.
It's frustrating that that's like such a universal experience for students. Mm-hmm. And I think I also hear that from students who are involved with, you know, basically every position on the diversity, equity, and inclusion spectrum. Everyone is like, says that they imagine that their institution would have been more supportive or, you know, would have had something in place to to support them. And I mean, especially like living in San Francisco and going to school there, mm-hmm. a really common thing that I think, like, you know, second years would say is, I thought that this was going to be really different. I thought that mm-hmm. the city or the school or something mm-hmm. would like have community for me or have a system in place for me to succeed. And that's generally not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So have your identities as an LGBTQ plus woman had any intersections with your career as a scientist so far? And if so, how?
Yes. Yeah, so now, I mean, I am really proud to be visible as an out queer woman scientist. Like, it's a huge part of my identity. It's a huge part of like the way that I think about like teaching and training students. But that definitely wasn't always the case for me. Like I said previously, like I think, you know, maybe my department changed over the time that I was at UCSF, but like I also definitely changed during that time. And mm-hmm. I can't remember if I mentioned this before, but I'm originally from Montana. And so I grew up in like a fairly conservative place with low to no queer representation. And so even when I like got all the way to San Francisco, you know, this like gay mecca for graduate school, I really was like not very comfortable at all with people knowing that I was gay. And so it was like a huge struggle to figure out like how to come out professionally, or like if it is mm-hmm. professional to be out. So I remember just like constantly like thinking and stressing about like who knew I was gay, who didn't know I was gay, like should I tell people, should I not tell people? And so mm-hmm. it sucked up like so much of my brain space, you know, like as a younger graduate school student, just like worrying about it. And so yeah, so it took like many years to figure out how to turn my queerness into this like very positive part of my scientific identity. And now I'm like, you know, really glad that I did that. And I'm really mm-hmm. glad that I was, you know, in a place and in an institution that made that a good thing. Because there are places where it's like certainly still legal to fire someone for being gay. And mm-hmm. so yeah. I like want to recognize that I'm really privileged that, you know, that I only had good experiences becoming more visible. And so yeah, now it's like this really wonderful, like great gift that I gave myself, but I definitely didn't always feel that way.
Yeah.
So we previously talked with Robbie about his experience co-founding the Graduate and Postdoctoral Queer Alliance. Can you tell us how you got involved and your experience as a co-founder there?
Yeah, so GPQA, or like some iteration of it, was an organization for queer students that was also, you know, ran by queer students that existed before I got to UCSF. And it was like active for, I think, like about a year into my graduate career there, after which it like kind of lost momentum and there wasn't really mm-hmm. anyone who was like going to keep it going, and the institution wasn't like in charge of yeah. making sure that this queer student group like stayed present and active on campus. And so it just kind of disappeared. I'm like, that was basically it for like queer graduate students. And so like over the years of like being a graduate student there, I guess I just got more and more frustrated that there weren't a lot of resources and that there was no one to advocate for LGBTQ mm-hmm. students, like especially transgender students. There was like nothing like looking out for trans students and trans postdocs. And so, you know, this was something I was thinking about and like getting frustrated about and trying to talk to faculty about for a while. And Robbie was a younger student who came to UCSF and really felt the same way. And so him and I were kind of like independently trying to talk to people and trying to raise awareness and like figure out how we could create something for queer students. And so we ended up just like gravitating towards each other and putting in the work to resurrect this queer student group together. And so that's something like I am so grateful that Robbie was there, like when he was there, and that we could like do this together. It definitely wouldn't have happened without him. Yeah.
And so what do you see in the future of GPQA now that you're like leaving UCSF and there's more students coming in, I guess?
Yeah, so I originally became involved with GPQA because I just felt like there was no one to advocate for queer students. And so I guess a lot of like my goals within the organization centered around just like trying to use it as a platform to advocate for students and to advocate for trainees and to like be that resource for people. And so Robbie and I like really saw eye to eye on making sure that GPQA could like be that mechanism to advocate for trainees and to, you know, advocate for social justice causes like within UCSF as an institution. And so like as there are more people coming in and more awareness, I am really excited to see where that advocacy work goes. I think that there's huge potential for what the students and trainees who are involved could do.
Yeah. So after this group was kind of resurrected and you and Robbie spent a lot of time working with kind of building it back up, did you, I know we've talked a little bit about this, but did you kind of start to see more recognition and maybe more support, maybe not just in your department, but in UCSF in general?
I think so. I mean, a lot of like resurrecting this student group was just like going to the same faculty, the same administrators, and like, you know, bothering them over and over again, be like, will you send out this email? Will you like, let me give a like blurb at your recruitment? Will you do this? Will you do this? And I think like after constantly contacting and engaging with the UCSF administration and UCSF faculty around advocating for queer students, they became more aware of the issues and also became more comfortable like being part of the conversation, because like now they knew me, they knew Robbie, they knew some of the issues that were going on, and maybe they also had like a little bit clearer of a direction of like what their place as a faculty member could be. And so I guess that would also be like something that could be amazing to happen with GPQA, is for faculty to engage with this organization and engage with the students and the trainees there, not just like queer faculty, but like also straight faculty, can figure out like how to work with this group of trainees and support them and further their agenda. That would be really awesome. And I think some of that work has like been started. There are definitely some incredible faculty members at UCSF who really want to be present and really want to be aware and really want to support these student organizations, because there are like a lot of amazing student organizations at UCSF. It's not just GPQA. There are tons of students who are fighting for like racial justice and advocating for people, and the faculty are a really key part in uplifting those efforts.
That's awesome. So you've mentioned that you're quite passionate about making science accessible to people with diverse backgrounds and identities. Can you tell us about your experiences in mentorships and training younger scientists or people who may be interested in science?
Yeah, so I believe very strongly in the importance of good mentorship. Like, as you pointed out before, almost every scientist has like a story about that one faculty member, that one teacher, that like one person who saw them as a scientist and supported them. And, you know, you can trace your career and your existence in science back to that one person. And I think it's really important that, like, you know, everybody get that opportunity to have at least one person be an advocate for them, because it is so critical. And so I guess I have focused a lot of my mentorship efforts toward undergraduates, since I think that like undergrad is this like very pivotal stage in your scientific training. You know, you see examples where graduate students or postdocs or faculty have made a really big difference in someone's career trajectory during their undergrad. Like, this is where people will decide to go to graduate school based on their amazing time in a lab, or will decide that they like don't want to do science because they work for a terrible person. So I think it's really critical that undergrads get to be in labs and are treated as like real scientists in those labs and are given real projects and like get that opportunity to be part of the scientific like community, and it'd be a good experience for them. So during graduate school, I was like somewhat involved with training and supporting some of the undergraduate students that came to UCSF through the summer research training program. So this is undergrads that like come from all over the country to spend, I think, like 3 months working in a UCSF lab. And so UCSF doesn't actually have its own undergrad population, so that's why when like undergrads come in through SRTP, I think it's like very important to, you know, find the ones in your neighborhood and support them and like help them practice their presentations or like, you know, whatever have you. And I also recruited some of my own undergrads from UC Berkeley, because like I said, UCSF doesn't have its own undergraduate population. Mm-hmm. And so during graduate school, I had hired two different really amazing, incredible undergraduate students, Jenny Zhang and Allison Park. And both Jenny and Allison commuted to Berkeley, which is like a long commute for a student to make. Mm-hmm. They would come from Berkeley to work with me, and they did this for the course of like several years. And they, you know, I like gave them real projects, and they did mm-hmm. like real science. Like they are authors on papers. They were huge parts of my PhD research. Like I would not have been able to make the progress I did without them, you know, working on their own projects alongside me, making their own discoveries, like, you know, truly being part of like my little team. And so, yeah, now Jenny is a first year graduate student at UCSF herself, which makes me so proud. And my other student, Allison, is finishing her degree at Berkeley. She's like an electrical engineering computer science student. And she just got a really amazing internship at IBM doing some biology computer thing that I don't know 100% about, but I'm like so proud of her for everything that she's achieved. So
yeah,
training my two students is like the best part of my PhD, like, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I am very grateful that during my undergrad, I got my own project, because I know of other labs that like take undergrads to do recrystallizations or only do columns. And I am 100% sure if I would have only been doing columns, I wouldn't be doing it right now, you know, because that would be so boring, you know, spending your whole research experience as an undergrad doing one, the single thing. Just like,
yeah,
you know, not interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it also puts like a really like weird pressure on that undergrad, because when you're doing like columns for somebody else, now that mm-hmm. person maybe is like, you know, not always like gonna be on your side. Like if you like mess it up or like something, you know, happens, it's like no one's fault. You know, if they like really needed that data or like really needed that protein prep in order to do their experiment the next day, like it's really easy to like blame a junior scientist. And I think that like, especially for junior scientists, like that is so crushing if you think that you've disappointed a more senior person. And if that senior person is like, you know, maybe not being like the nicest about it. So I think it's like actually very like important that undergrads be given their own, you know, kind of little research zone where the stakes are different and they're just here to learn. And you as your mentor can like always be on their side, like even if they like ruin everything, you know, like the only thing you want to do is help them fix it. You're not like freaking out because some part of your project has now been compromised.
Definitely. Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, you're currently working at your graduate PI startup before beginning as a Miller Fellow at UC Berkeley in the fall, like you mentioned, next week. Or, yeah, next week.
Yeah.
Not next week when this episode airs. Next week.
Yeah.
When
being recorded. I guess, yeah, when this episode airs, I guess you'll be at Berkeley.
Yeah, I will be a real postdoc. How weird. Yeah.
So can you tell us about your experience working in the startup?
Yeah, so this is, like, something really interesting and fun that I totally did not like have planned for myself in my career trajectory. As I said before, I did my graduate research studying these phage proteins called anti-CRISPRs that inhibit CRISPR from working. And so the phage uses these to protect itself from this CRISPR immune system. But since CRISPR is like moving into the clinic and being used as this very popular gene editing tool, there are also, you can imagine, like really clear like requirements for making sure that it's safe, that it isn't toxic, that it doesn't go cut the wrong part of DNA. And so having these like, you know, protein off switches or like little protein modules that you can use to control CRISPR activity is really important for making CRISPR and gene editing in general safe. And so my PI started a company, I think during my last year in graduate school, around that idea, using anti-CRISPRs to make gene editing safer. And so when I was like trying to figure out my graduation timeline and just, you know, figure all of that out, they asked me if I'd be interested in just coming to like work for the company for like 3 to 6 months and just help them set stuff up and be a part of it and, you know, contribute however I wanted to, and then leave and go do my postdoc. And so I decided to take the little detour and work in industry for a little bit. And it's been so much fun. It's really cool to see, you know, this like very fundamental biology that I studied during my PhD, which was like phage proteins, you know, being moved towards something that's translational, being moved towards something that's like maybe going to go into people, that's going to like be part of like a cure for a disease. I definitely did not get into studying phages because I thought that I was doing something related to human health and disease, but it's been really amazing to like see that, you know, full discovery trajectory from moving something from a very, very academic lab to like, you know, one day potentially being a cure for a disease that's sold and given to patients.
And so moving forward from that, can you tell us about your decision to continue your education at Berkeley?
Yeah, so I am super excited to stay in the Bay Area and to be at Berkeley. I've found like a really wonderful lab to join, and I got my position funded through this Berkeley Miller Fellowship, which like seems like a really awesome opportunity. And yeah, so it was kind of hard actually to figure out like where to do my postdoc, because there's so much propaganda basically around the idea that like scientists just need to like move like every position. Like, you know, you do your undergrad somewhere, like you leave, you like do graduate school somewhere, you better go somewhere else to do your postdoc. Like, and I didn't want to move. Like, me and my partner have like, you know, a, like good life in the Bay Area. It would have required that like their job get messed up and that we like just kind of arbitrarily go somewhere else because that's like what you're supposed to do. And so I decided to just apply to Bay Area schools and figure out how to do a postdoc there. And I am like so glad that I made that decision and that I get to like keep living where I'm living and my partner doesn't have to like find a new job. So I definitely chose to go to Berkeley for like what you would consider to be more personal reasons, but I also know that I'm not a very good scientist when I'm like miserable and unhappy.
So I don't know who is like, I definitely hear you on that one.
So I think personal reasons are also professional.
Definitely.
We don't think about this often, but there's a lot of like personal things included in being a scientist, you know, having to move like several times because, you know, maybe after a postdoc, then you get a position in somewhere that you want to work and it might not be where you live right now. So you have to move for maybe a second or third time. And starting a new life, basically, you know, meeting like new neighbors and making new friends if they're not there.
And then especially once you have like a partner or like a long-term relationship, that's like something else that you have to factor in. I mean, we don't have to worry about that right now, but maybe in 5 years we will.
Shut up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like especially relevant as queer people because you can't just like move anywhere in the country, you know? Like, it's like there are a subset of places where it is like, where it can feel like a great idea to for you and like your queer partner, if you have one, to like pick up and
set up your life. And I think also like maybe an experience that is a little bit more universal when it comes to queer people is that like finding a queer community is also kind of difficult. And you're right, like you can't necessarily find it everywhere, or like certain places will have like more opportunity to build a really good community. I know that like when I was moving from Memphis, where I did my undergrad, to Michigan, that was a really, really hard move for me because I wasn't in a long-term relationship, but I had a really, really close-knit queer community. And that's terrifying to leave that behind, because mm-hmm. for a lot of queer people, that's like your second family or your chosen family.
Yeah.
And so that's like another thing to take into consideration of all of these moves that you're doing in your like mid to late 20s, early 30s, definitely affects like what community you're able to build as a queer person.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I'm even like moving from, you know, spending all my time in San Francisco to spending my time in the East Bay. And I'm like, no, my friends are so far away. I'm like already freaking out about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So how are you celebrating and honoring Pride Month amidst this pandemic and also kind of the current cultural climate that we're in?
Yeah. So I guess my thoughts on it are, given the history of Stonewall and Pride, there's probably no better way to honor that than by like showing up and supporting all these protests that are happening currently against police brutality. So me and my partner have been donating money and, you know, showing up in person when we can, mm-hmm. and, you know, plan to do that for Pride Month and continue doing it for as long as is necessary. And I think that that's like a great way that all queer people who feel comfortable can honor Pride Month is by showing up.
Yeah,
definitely. So who is your biggest role model in the STEM field and why? And you can have more than one if you have multiple.
Yeah.
All right, I have many, but I'm just going to pick one. my biggest role model is definitely a former, I guess she's still my current mentor, but a professor at UCSF. Her name is Sime Chow, and she is a PI, and she worked in the same department as me, and her lab was like right next to the lab that I did my graduate work in. She is like an amazing scientist. I encourage everyone listening and you too to like look up her science. She's built this incredible interdisciplinary lab that studies Lyme disease transmission by ticks. So she started off as a structural biochemist. So she studies like how ticks work and how Lyme disease works on like the molecular level with like looking at proteins and structures. But then she also has built this lab that like actually studies like real ticks and like actually studies Lyme disease transmission. And so she like really has taken this serious health problem mm-hmm. and is attacking it from every single angle possible. And like as a result, I think the science that she does is like so unique and so exciting and always so impactful. And so when I think of like what kind of PI I want to be, what kind of science I want to do, I always think of her because she like goes after these problems like so kind of like holistically, but by like getting at like all of the parts that are so critical to this like big kind of puzzle that is like disease transmission and vector biology. And she's also a really great advocate for trainees and for bringing about systemic changes in the scientific academy. So she uses like the same kind of like holistic but like scientifically rigorous approach to attacking like really hard institutional problems. And she just like does not give up. She takes these like institutional issues really seriously, and then she just like troubleshoots them exactly like you would an experiment. And I respect that so much. And I think that like basically all scientists who want to be advocates can learn from that approach, because I think scientists are so willing to like learn whatever technique or idea mm-hmm. or like concept they need to do their research. But then when it comes to like figuring out how to like make an institution less racist or more supportive to queer students, like they're like, well, I don't know how to do that. That seems so hard.
Right.
Yeah. And if they just like treated it like a scientific problem that you need to use reason and logic mm-hmm. and like pedagogical resources to get to the bottom to, I think science and like institutions could actually move very quickly to become, you know, everything that they want themselves to be and certainly that we want them to be.
That's amazing. That's
amazing. True. Mm-hmm. And we'll definitely check out her work.
Yes.
I'm excited.
You should do it.
Yeah.
This is great.
So last question, where can people find you on social media if they want to connect with you?
Yeah, so I have a Twitter at Adair L. Borges, and that's definitely the best way to find me. It's my science Twitter that became pretty gay pretty quickly.
I think that's the same for a lot of us. Yeah. There's like science Twitter, but like very gay.
Yeah. Yeah, my PI told me to make it as like a science communication tool because he's on Twitter and he was like, Adair, you gotta do this. It's great. Like all yeah. these scientists are there. And like 2 months in, the gay Twitter is not the science.
Yeah. Well, that was all we had for you. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation.
Yeah, thank you. It was very lovely.
Yeah, yeah, it was so great talking to both of you. I always love meeting other queer scientists.
Yeah.
So thank you for getting a hold of me.
Yeah, definitely. Of course.
All right. Have a good day.
You
all
too.
Right, you too.
Bye. Bye.
Let us honor Pride Month by showing up for our trans siblings and the Black community who both need our support right now.
As always, remember to fill out the nomination form on our Twitter if you're interested in being interviewed for the show. You can follow us at MFQCpod. Take care, everybody, and stay safe.
Bye.
Adios.